in an old house on 44th Street that doubles as an administrative office for the Kemper Museum, a handful of tiny paintings about the size of an index card depict trees and flowers and bridges. Simple things. They're pretty, but if you didn't know the story behind them, you could be forgiven for passing by after a moment's glance. The artist who painted these canvases, a woman by the name of Hung Lu, began studying art in China in the 1970s, when Mao Zedong was in power. She would go out into the countryside alone to paint things she found beautiful. This was against the law in Mao's China, where artists were required to support ideology with every brushstroke. Hung Lu concealed these small canvases, and she kept them hidden throughout the Cultural Revolution. The story turns these pretty little canvases, these flowers and trees and bridges, into significant acts of rebellion. Hung Lu, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Those paintings I just described, do you remember the first time you decided to go out and paint for pleasure, even though it was against the law?
First of all, I went to teacher's college. That was after 4 years working in the in the countryside, in the field with the peasants, shoulder to shoulder, literally, because they end towards the big revolution. The beginning of a Cultural Revolution started in 1966. In 1968, Mao Zedong sent all of the educated people from junior high students up to famous writers and artists, all those novelists, anybody you name, musicians, to either military labor farm or countryside. Because I was just in the high school, ready to go to college. So we were sent to the countryside, work in the field.
And that was called re-education, right?
Absolutely. Because we learned too much non-proletarian knowledge, which need to be completely wiped out through hard work, through working in the field and do the hardest labor, then we could clear our the other kind of brainwash, but through labor.
Will you talk a little bit more about the labor that you performed during your so-called re-education?
I was sent to the countryside, and like a military farm, so relatively loose in the sense that the military officers, the bugle went, up 4 a.m. But we did have to get up during harvest season. We had big speakers, very loud speakers. 3 o'clock, everybody woke up during harvest season. We just one after the other in the dark went to the wheat field and harvest wheat with our bare hands. Pull them out because we need to save the lower part with the roots as a fuel, because there's no fuel for heating. And so there was no weekend. Never heard there's a weekend. So 7/24, you work in the field all seasons except Chinese New Year, which is in late January or February, depends Chinese lunar calendar.
So one day off per year?
Two or three days, that's Chinese New Year. And you didn't, nobody earn any wage. There's no such thing called a wage.
Where did you live? How did you sustain yourself?
The countryside at that time called the big one called the commune. One commune. It's now like a county almost, or maybe and have a lot of little teams, villages, each one called a team. So it's almost like a full military organization, everything organized. So we were there, and the village had to provide houses for our to stay. In the beginning, we stayed with the peasants. Then there's a house just for us. So-called intellectuals from the cities need to be re-educated. So if we live together, we have to take turn to cook with the giant wok, the fuels from countryside, and there was no fish, no vegetable, no cooking oil, no meat. So it's interesting, very hard. We were from a city. We didn't know much. China was poor overall, everything rationed, but still, we had never seen that level of poverty in anywhere in China because we city people.
You took photographs during that time, which were like the canvases you painted, illegal. How did you get your hands on the camera that you used?
Camera was just by accident. I have some friends, they older than me. They went to film academy in Beijing. So they are like a professional artist, and they studied not as a acting, but rather like a stage set, you know. And one of them had an old German camera, you know, the old called 120. It's a box camera. And they were all, because they got more education, they are higher level college. So they were sent to the military camp, labor camp. Before they left, one of the one who had this camera gave me to keep, said if in the military camp, probably will be confiscated. This camera is considered a really bad thing associated with bourgeoisie, even, you know, kind of counter-revolutionary act, because you're not allowed to take pictures anywhere you want, especially like during Cultural Revolution. I remember the Italian filmmaker Antonioni he made a documentary called China, was broadly criticized as anti-China, anti-socialism, because he took pictures, very normal picture of countryside, because none of the peasants had like a bathroom. They all had old house. And he could have a peasant came out from old house, tidying his pants. And then next to some Peking, famous revolutionary Peking opera, and then pigs. And he was criticized so badly because you, in China, photography is supposed to be done only, by the party line, meaning front view, everybody, should be happy and should be really heroic. You know, you pose for the photo, but the candid shot was considered really dangerous because you could expose the site. The government really didn't want anybody to see. So the camera would be evidence of not being really pure proletarian. So I just had to keep this camera for that friend.
So, and you got a hold of film, too. I mean, that's just the logistics of getting a hold of everything you need seems like it would be tricky if it was illegal.
My mom was a teacher. I had to ask. I had no money. We didn't make money until the end of the year. Some people work all year long, still owes the commune money. And so I asked my mom, can I buy a couple roll of this? You have to buy the real film. Today, digital age, you don't see anything material. You just take photo in your, library. Just everything is in the cloud. It's virtual. So I have to, not super expensive, but for Chinese, it's not cheap either. You know, nobody had a camera. So I got a few rolls of film and took back to the countryside. Those kind of film marked 24 exposure, 36. I remember 36 is the highest. But I have to count your hand. I didn't know how to load it. So at the Photoshop, I have to ask the salesman, say, how can you load this film into the camera? So in the black bag, because nothing can be exposed to light. So he did for me. He showed me. So I had no training, had no any knowledge, because nobody had camera. So with this camera, I had a lot of adventure.
Yeah, you in the exhibit at the Kemper, there's part of it that shows some some objects, some pieces of work from before you came to the United States. And these are few and far between, hard to get a hold of. The ones that are there, the small paintings, illegal. The photographs, also illegal. But these are portraits that you took of people in the countryside during your re-education, during the Cultural Revolution, and you did not develop them until 2010.
Yeah, that's about right. What happened was that you, first of all, if you had a camera, it's a big target. Could be, you know, could get you a lot of trouble. So because I was in the lowest of the, all the low level, the countryside, so nobody really, you know, have gone there try to find any, you know, problem, because we already sent away, meaning we exiled. So there, relatively, the peasants, they didn't mind. And especially after years of working together, I happened to have a camera, I remember. So I said, we in China, we're very polite. We older people, we call them auntie, uncle, you know, and even older, we call grandpa. Grandma is not our own, but we, you know, respectfully call them the right, you know, generation, gave them that title.
Using the familiar terms for anyone you encounter.
Absolutely. And then, for example, like some older peasants and lady, I said, Grandma, do you mind if I take picture of you? And they know me. They know I won't do anything bad, because some, I remember some older peasant passed by. He was probably in his 60s. He said, oh my God, those things called camera is a magic box. Will capture your soul, your spirit. It's dangerous. Don't do that. But because they know me, they knew me well enough by working together. So I got to take a lot of pictures. Also, in Susan Sontag's article about talk about the candid shots, you know, I did really snapshot. It's not like they pose, pretend they are happy or pretend they are heroic. They pretty much, most of them, they were themselves. And like the country boys, they jump, dive in their, you know, nearby, their village surrounded by water. So they learned to swim when they were little, very young. So they jumped and then came out, and they have their own sunblock. It's the mud on their face. It's just happy. And so I took pictures. Nobody super alert. So no. You know, you didn't get my permission, nothing like that. So it's a friendly, and some actually, I went to the city, asked my mom for money, said I needed to print out some because I promised to give to them. They want to see what I have taken, but there's no dark room. That time, dark room was really dark room. You have a dark room, you have a red bulb, light bulb. For the safety, the film, the paper, and I didn't have any of this, so I have to wait for like after midnight and painted my light bulb red, and waited dark enough, and I opened the paper, and I didn't have timer, I didn't have enlarger. I have to ask my mom a little money, went to the second a hand store, bought a big camera lens on a pole. It's like a enlarger. I have to hand
like
count.
A magnifying glass.
Exactly that. Like I never done that. I thought it was magic. I stay up all night. Next morning, I put all this developed photograph on the window. The first time I didn't have experience, the window dirty, so they stick there. And when I peel off, some ruined, so I learned to clean the window. So everything is so primitive. But because so primitive in China, even doable. But you just have to, for example, if I count 20 seconds, overexpose, the whole photograph becomes dark. Then it's like, how about cut down? It's too underexposed. So that kind of a really a primitive way, you know, to do it. It gave me a lot of fun. Plus, when I can enlarge, crop others out, just all the unnecessary background out, just the head. I was so happy, and as if I did my editing. So when I went back to the countryside, gave the peasants their photographs, that was like a festival.
So you had developed some of these photos previously, shortly after you took them, but in 2010, what was it then that happened? Had you just had some of them been undeveloped, the ones you still had on film, or what was it that happened in 2010 that was new?
2010, I came to U.S., which was exactly 30 years ago. I think I just packed the negatives, about 70, 80 of them. Majority, I never had chance to print that. Photographs out, you know, just negatives. I wrapped in the old handkerchief and just somewhere forever with me. But 2010, I always thought, oh my God, I want to see what's there. I took those pictures. So finally, I had a chance to, we have a graduate program at Mills College, which I taught for 24 years. There's a photography. So I hired graduate students. So it's still doable to develop this black white old film, you know, from 40 years ago.
What was it like to see these faces and these people and these settings decades later?
I think it brought back a lot of memories, even some names I remember the circumstances, but again, comes back to my campus, the title of this my retrospective, Summoning Ghost. Because what is a ghost? Our past could be ghosts. We don't have to be dead, and our ancestors' ghosts, but also those people and friends who were in my life, and I captured their feature with a snapshot, because all natural light and there's no any special effect, nothing like that. But 40 years later, they're, even if they're still around, like the young girl, there's one I really love her called like Little Swan. I always thought she's such a most beautiful thing. Nobody thought so. I thought she's such a great country girl. And now she's way over 50. You can say older lady, right? But I think I captured a moment. That moment becomes very ghosty. It doesn't exist anymore. Maybe she even didn't remember. So I feel somehow by doing a landscape secretly try to make connection, create a environment just to survive mentally, not go crazy, completely wiped out by revolution, and to capture whatever a tree or after rain, the muddy road or a ruin of a palace, all those, you know, and with the photographs, to me, maybe I started a long time ago summoning the ghost, meaning I really don't want a lot of ghosts just gone without noticed, without recognized. And I need to honor them. I need to give them a memorial kind of a service.
You've had a couple of different experiences in your life where there was a rupture and you were pulled away from a place that you had called home, whether willingly or unwillingly, like going from your family and being with your family to this re-education. You're just a teenager. And then coming from China to the United States, mm-hmm. There was also an experience of leaving things behind. Is that part of the summoning ghosts idea, this sort of traveling back across these ruptures and bringing something with you?
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Actually, a location, a place could become a ghost too, because, they all say we cannot go home. So what is home? Hometown where you're born, we fill out sometimes look at our resume. I was born in Changchun, which was under siege by the communist PLA, blah, 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 48. That place I went back for a conference years, maybe about 8 years ago. it was not a tongue I remembered at all. Maybe I've changed a lot, but the tongue changed a lot. Everybody changed. So there's nothing still. To me, I think you're absolutely right. Why a lot of people still try to go to graveyard to mourn the, to honor the dead, to have a day of death. Various cultures are different. Kind of way to remember the dead, the past. I think that's a place. It's very important. To me, my mom asked not to be buried, so she wants to be in the ocean. So we spread her ashes in the middle between China and the United States, which is Hawaii. And so there's not a place per se, but I knew she's in the water. To me, I think as an artist, I left home, hometown, home country, but the home, the country, the culture never left me. Living U.S. is new home. I feel here is more like my home. But how to honor or to remember, I think my painting service, in most cases, canvas, probably is a memorial site, like a graveyard, to honor the anonymous people I never met, but I happened to see their pictures of refugees, prostitutes, laborers, prisoners, soldiers, all kind of, people pass by, never left a trace in a way. So I feel it's important, maybe my lifetime mission since a long time ago.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. We'll get back to this conversation with artist Hung Liu in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. You're listening to a portrait session on Central Standard. Our subject today is artist Hung Liu, who has an exhibit at the Kemper called Summoning Ghosts. We've been talking about her memories growing up in communist China under the rule of Mao Zedong and about her artwork referencing that time. I've heard your paintings described, especially the paintings that do show kind of people under duress, political or economic, social duress, or just with physical ailments or struggles that you have. I've heard the paintings of these kinds of characters described as second chance paintings, which I thought was a really kind of interesting idea. Like there's a woman a portrait of a prostitute in this exhibit. And she's portrayed there very sort of starkly with a child, but there's like a gold halo over her almost. It's not that you're portraying her other than she is, but all of the environment around her in that painting is sort of adding something rich and vibrant and noble. Is that part of the idea, like a second chance?
That's why I titled that painting Madonna. What is Madonna? It's like a holy mother with, holy baby. But there is a Chinese prostitute from 19th century, late 19th century, early 20s, and with a Caucasian baby and wrapped up, which is already really odd thing. And then what's the purpose of this photograph? It's to attract clients because she was a prostitute, and I found those books in China which say, come here, there's this type of woman you might want. This is just in different costumes with different accoutrement. So I titled her Madonna with a halo behind her, really in the hope it's another kind of memorial, like to remember her. Will never know her name, her story, her family. Probably no way we could find more information. But her face is undeniably, evidence that she exists for don't know how long. But for, in my work, in my painting, I feel I want to honor her, like enshrine her in the way you said. But also, I feel like this individual, will be remembered by me first. And whoever see that will remember her, to honor her. Also, maybe say she can now rest in peace, little bit better.
One of you talked a little bit, your mother has come up a couple of times, and there's a painting that's very known to people in Kansas City who follow your work, Munu. I don't know if I've said that right, but mother, daughter. It's a huge canvas, horizontal, with two women who are connected by a rope, and there are vertical drips or streaks over them, between them and the viewer. That's part of a lot of your paintings, mm-hmm. and maybe we'll talk about that a little bit mm-hmm. too. But these two figures are connected by a rope. They're traveling over rocks on shallow water, and they appear to be pulling something heavy, which I've heard is supposed to be a boat, mm-hmm. but I don't know that for mm-hmm. sure. This is a very poignant image. You haven't been told who is the mother and who is the daughter. You don't see a lot of their features, but you can kind of pick out who is who, mm-hmm. and you don't know what they're pulling, what they're doing, why they're doing it, but there's something very powerful about it, even not knowing. Can you talk about that painting and about what it may or may not have to do with you and your mother?
I think that should you bring that up, it's very interesting why I was doing that painting and my studio process. My mom visited us. She lived in Beijing, visited us 6-7 times during the time being, and I was painting that. I said, Mom, that's us. So, which really, you know, that was not us. You know, that's when she got it, I think, like you said, it described not physically kind of working hard, you know, bending over, you know, back-breaking kind of job. But over the years, you know, everybody in China, my generation and my mom's generation, gone through so much, life and death. And sometimes I think if you really want to have a draw analogy, look at what's North Korea today. Very much like China 40 years ago. It's hard to imagine, but they lived through. So the physical burden is the metaphor for psychological, emotional burden and the repression, politically, you know, all the stuff. And you describe very well the mother still ahead, like a mother is leading the daughter alive, and they tied by rope, you know. So there's a family tie, the generation tied.
But they're also tied to a weight that they're carrying.
Yes, they're working together. But also, if you pay a little bit of attention, when I was doing that, I found more and more to myself. And they walk as if not exactly line up. So I'm thinking there's a generation tied, but also generation gap. Maybe the younger generation will heading slightly different direction. Maybe the future will be a little different, not only like mother, like daughter. Maybe something will be more positive. Maybe she can stand up, you know, straight for a while, look at the future. And behind them, there are a lot of washes and drips. Those things, you know, it occurred a lot in my painting because I was trained in China as a socialist, a realistic style, which is directly came from the old Soviet Union. Everything has to be painted with a detail, and also the political label is a socialist. You know, you have to have to the great leader, the happy peasants, the heroic soldier, all the stuff, it's all assigned is along the party line. So this one, unlike those happy, heroic, working class people, rather they just doing their daily labor. So those washes almost loosened up the whole background, wash them over. So remind me of once I have a group children there, as they said, washes. I know what is the tears, sweat, you know. So I think they just paint this washing, dripping painting, but it could in different situation. And the bigger thing is not the literal, just the tear or blood or sweat. I think it's a way about erosion, about the kind of dissolution of history. What we're seeing, because I use a lot of historical photographs, they already taken long time ago, somewhere, some place we don't know, and a lot lost the any information. So it's this dissolution of history also try to reach, but interrupted by the wash, by the drips. So not focused, a constantly history can be really tricky. We can sometimes people find a new evidence to rewrite history, to change some. But I think there's a distance between us and history.
That's really interesting, because what it's always looked like to me, and this is just how I see it, but it looks like there's a screen, but it's sort of a warped and colorful screen that's sort of kind of frustrating you, because it's between you and this image, but it's so colorful and attractive in a way that you don't really mind.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's you use a screen, it's really good. I think like a screen, like a veil. When we see through, when you have a pouring rain, you're in the car, you still can see what's outside, but constantly interrupted by the pouring rain. So it creates another layer to see so-called what's the surrounding the reality. So history was once a reality to those people, for sure, who were captured in the photographs, but also to us, it's long distance. That distance is not just in terms of temporal, but also spatial distance, but the psychological distance. So by working in the countryside, by going through a lot myself, and by watching friends died and punish the Cultural Revolution and beyond, I feel like I have a life experience to explore and to relate to, those people, even though I never knew them. Another fact is that all my historical photographs are black white, and quite a few very blurry. So I made up colors. What color should I give mother, Muni, give the mother and the daughter? And when I was doing that and working in the cornfield, we sweat really all over us. And the morning when you harvest the wheat, use your hand, pull the wheat with mud all over our face, we basically colorless. Now, regardless what kind of clothes you wear, it's covered by mud. So yes, there's color, some color vivid, just a hint, but a lot washed away and bleached by time, by labor, by sweat, by sun, by memory.
That's when I was at the Kemper to see this show, I asked the security guard about what do people ask her most when they're looking at this show? And she said the question that the most people ask her is, why are some of the faces so vivid, so clear, and other faces you can't make out the features at all? And I was surprised that was the most commonly asked question, but it sounds like in a way you've maybe answered that maybe just the source material, the photographs, mm-hmm. Some of the faces weren't in focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some shot at the photo studio, like the prostitute, because for selling them, you have better, like today's mail order catalog, you get the product very look good, you package them, then you photograph them, like desirable. That's different purpose. And for other snapshot, the Muni pulling the boat, they in motion. And also they were not aware they were photographed. They're not returning the gaze. So that's a different kind of photograph. And also I think it's very interesting. In Chinese, photography was translated 摄影. 摄影, 摄 means capture, snatch. 影 is a shadow. So in actually photography, in the original word, the photo is light, and the graph is a picture of light. But we try to capture the shadow in Chinese translation. So what is a shadow? Shadow is ghosty. So I think it's very interesting how much shadow you can catch, you can capture, how clear the shadow is. Sometimes we can tell what it is, you know, when by looking at the shadow. Sometimes we can't. All we can have is a ghost shadow. So I think that different quality of the photographs, also different purpose use. And to me, what kind of impact I have working women in the water, in the field, is different than prostitute posing them like ready to be, you know, to be purchased. It's a different purpose too.
A lot of your really recent work has to do with propaganda. And there is a pair of works of art, one a video and one a painting, that refer back to a propaganda film from your childhood that you saw when you were little, a black and white reel about, if I understand correctly, women soldiers who took their dying wounded to the water to drown instead of surrendering.
You got that. You got it right.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how old you were when you first saw this video?
I was born 48. This movie was made in 49, 1 year younger than me. Of course, I didn't watch when I was 1 year old. I think it's very young. I would say could be 5 years old. And it's called The Daughters of China, the name of the movie. So just about maybe 8 years ago or something, I went to China 7, 8 years ago. I saw DVD. I could not believe it because it's like, this is one of the oldest movies I could think.
Where was the DVD?
Beijing.
Just in a store?
In a store, because now I think there's a kind of a nostalgia, you know, for revolution, for Mao Zedong died, even nostalgia for Chairman Mao, because when he was ruining us, everybody was poor, nobody had anything, no telephone, and no way to get out of China. I think a relatively high repressed society, in a way, people probably no choice. But now some people are so rich, a lot of people are still poor. So I think a lot of anxiety and disillusion about this where the country going. So when they really walk in the river after they run out the option, the Japanese pushing to closer and use machine gun, and they carry their wounded, dying comrade, 8 of them. It's very famous in Chinese histories, like 8 women. The 8 women, we always talk about for a long, long time, but that was the only movie, you know, try to kind of replace a documentary, because they're not document. And so reminds me of a Russian early Soviet Union film, the battleship Potemkin and Black White. So the river, walking into the river, always was the most very moving moment. I was surprised, actually. I was rather moved by the way the 8 women carrying their comrade walking right into the water, then submerged.
Hold that thought. When we come back to this conversation with Hung Lu, we'll hear about her move to the United States, leaving China behind, and her relationship with Kansas City. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today I'm speaking with artist Hung Lu. You can see a portrait of Hung Lu taken by Paul Andrews on our website later today. Hung Lu, when you came to the United States, you were what, 36 years old?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you think that you would stay here, make a life here, or did you think you would be heading back home? And I just wonder what it was like for you getting here, your expectations of what it would be like and the reality of it.
You don't know. You're 36. You had not ever been on any airplane. Nobody had a passport in order to wait for my Chinese passport. It took me almost 4 years. And was rejected, sometimes not, you know, clear rejected. They said, I lost my materials, admission to graduate school, UCSD. So I had to do all over again. It was so unimaginable that finally, actually, I was on the airplane, first time in my life. I had no idea. It took off. Like, that was the moment I could fly. When you can fly, you don't know how far you can fly. And what's the other side of the Pacific like? No clue. We knew some thing about America, and the few things I read is American went to the moon, you know. So the Soviet Union went to the moon. That's big news. Otherwise, we saw cartoons of a big Fed, Wall Street, you know, bankers with cigar, all kind of things. We had no clue. But I knew in Boston Museum, there's a beautiful collection of Chinese traditional temple paintings, sculpture. I knew it's a freer country. No clue. We criticized so many times, so many years about capitalism, how bad. And so I think you just go sometimes, you take whatever Robert Frost said, you know, take the less traveled by and then see what happened.
When your work that you've created in the United States has so much to do with China and with the past, but what has your present life in the United States, what has it been like for you? Has it been, are there things that you miss? Are there things that, is that just another life to you that almost?
I think one can never say from today on, I'm brand new, I'll get rid of the past. You can never get rid of the past. So in that case, I have a ghost inside me, the ghost of myself when I was 5, when I was 10, when I was 36. So I just posted exactly the day I entered the U.S., which is October 26. I had a picture. I went through Shanghai custom to leave China. I asked some fellow, I think by that time I had a pretty bad camera, but some fellow travelers, I have no clue, no memory, take picture of me. And then I have a picture of me in front of a big Air China airplane in Shanghai, ready to leave China. So look at the picture. That was me. That was not me. And I was 30 years younger, but also what was on my mind, like you said, did I have a plan? Did I have I don't know. But all I had was a determination. I want to go to some place that I want to be a better artist. I'm not afraid. I will see what next. But what does mean by being better artist? I think I want to be a better artist than who I am now. I just want to keep changing. And Benjamin Franklin said, if you are finished changing, you are finished. So I don't want to be finished yet. So that's as a continuation. I think that's consistent. What I miss, I wish between China and U.S. or between U.S. and Europe and the whole world, you know, it could be a shorter trip if we can just kick my slippers. I can be somewhere. I will go
Ruby more slippers.
And the red ruby, absolutely. It's in the almost right place, right?
Exactly.
See, my name's not Dorothy, but I can still feel like if I could do that, I want to, you know, physically go to places more, to see more shows with more friends. But on the other hand, I feel it's good. I have a great studio. I was a professor of studio art, teaching for 24 years at Mills College. So what a privilege.
I can't let this conversation end without talking to you about your relationship with Kansas City, because your work is all over the place here. There are several galleries who collect and show your work, museums here. When did you first develop this relationship with Kansas City?
That was a long time ago. And one person I have to say I want to give my big thanks that was Baron Cohen.
Byron Cohen, yeah.
Baron Cohen, he passed away. We did this last show in September at the Sherry Lee Gallery with Baron's daughter, Toma, and his wife, Eileen, and in memory of Baron Cohen, I did that show. He had a lot of clients, and he made connection with me and the Kemper Museum, and Mr. Kemper, and Mrs. Kemper then. And but overall, somehow, 15 years ago, my 10-year survey traveled here at Kemper Museum. And I still have banners they gave to me at my studio. And the Kemper Museum has the most pieces of my work in the collection. I think the other comparable gallery, museum, will be San Jose Museum. So I
and
feel...
that's much closer to where you live.
It's not that closer, but this is like home away from home. I feel I have so many friends, and not just collectors, art dealers, and museum people like you. I made friends. Also, when we watch it, Giant and Royals in on TV in the Bay Area, naturally, we're supposed to be for Giant. But my husband, Jeff, and I, we keep saying, we don't mind, you know, Kansas City Royals win, because we feel in our heart, feel warmly with Kansas City. It's a sim, and he kept saying, it's a beautiful place, you know. So as being here, it's coming to home. You know, I feel like me, I'm an immigrant. So what is home? I think home is where you have dear friends, like extended family. You feel you really want to go, and you have your spirit up. So I feel want to say I love Kansas City and the people here and all the dear friends.
Just one last question for you, and this is also about Kansas City. A lot of your art lives here, so it's not just a home away from home. It's a home for a lot of what you've created. Is there a work of art of yours that lives in Kansas City that means something really special to you that you'd be willing to talk about?
I think there are quite a few. It's really hard for me to just recent show, for example, there are few oil paintings, one of which from exactly 20 years ago is two Chinese boys with donkeys tilling the soil. That's the title of the show, Tilling the Soil. And then it's also, you know, barren, you know, probably dust to dust, you know, going back to, you know, to another world. So some way that painting was, you know, purchased by, you know, by a collector, first time collecting my work. And another big one was really two big panels called diptych, right? A corn carrier, different kind of, I think there's one smaller one on canvas. This is on board, a woman carrying corn, you know, in a very heavy load. That's like almost like a self it's autobiographical. Yes, like me carrying heavy load on my back. So, and the people, another person, you know, collector brought his son about that. So those paintings to me means a lot. And the subject matter, you can say Chinese and not you know, white, not black, but something made me feel really welcome. I always joked, but it's not really a joke. I said, I created those paintings, the works. They like my babies in a way, you know, maybe like cliche to my babies. But if somebody had them in their home, then we become in-laws. So I have so many relatives, in-laws in Kansas City. I just feel so welcome and also warm about that, because I even cannot count how many my babies with what in-laws, but I want to say hello in the air to all my in-laws here, and the Kemper Museum is one of them.
Hung Lu, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been really fun.
Thank you, Gina. That's great to work to talk to you.
To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are at @KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR.